profession.
Thanks. So the first part will be on rats, and then the second part, although I have some doubts whether we'll ever get to the second part, will be on, as David said, some more recent work on people, because there is an observation in the rats that inspired a set of experiments on humans, which have been we've been following through on for the last year and a half or so. These are the people who've done the work, Justin Harrison, Tansu Chelikel on tactile learning, cortical response maps, Rasmus Peterson, cortical coding, Stefano Panzeri, Rasmus, Misha Lebedev, and cortical plasticity, Irina Ersheva, although I think that we'll probably skip that part of the talk for time reasons. And then the work on people has mainly been done by Justin Harris. So the rat whisker system is, it's worthwhile to keep in mind that although rats perhaps don't have the highest cognitive abilities of any species, with their whisker system they have superb tactile capacities when compared to what humans can learn to discriminate with their fingertips. It turns out that rats can learn the same things with their whiskers, the same degree of fineness. So it's a highly developed system, and certainly understanding neuronal representations of stimuli in this system is worthwhile because of the degree of specialization in the system. Rats use their whiskers for everything that they do. They don't, especially albino rats, don't use vision. They probably don't use hearing that much, but they use their whiskers to explore, to detect objects, to discriminate shapes and roughnesses, textures, and so on. And besides the fact that it's such a specialized system, another reason that the whiskers are a good system to study is because they're so stereotyped in their arrangement. All the rats have, maybe I'll get this. Well, not very much, but certainly albino rats don't. Albino, pigmented rats a little bit, but albino rats hardly at all. In fact, we study them in tactile tasks in the dark, and they do fine. So every rat has its whiskers arranged in arcs and rows, which means that as soon as you see any rat that you take into the laboratory, you can identify every whisker on its face according to this coordinate system, C3, B4, E1, and so on. So for the rest of this presentation, you'll hear this coordinate system used over and over again. And that's experimentally very useful. It's very handy to have the same coordinates in every rat.
So this,
yeah, they have the same number. There's a little bit of variation in this part, but in this part it's the same in every rat. So the sensory system begins in the whisker follicle, where these are probably stretch receptors that are sensitive to whisker movement. And this is a gross oversimplification of the somatosensory pathway that would offend a lot of people. It should offend myself, because I've studied this part of it more. But today we'll just talk about the barrel cortex, the somatosensory cortex, and forget about any sort of integration or coding or anything that's happening before the cortex. The cortex itself is one of the best anatomical, morphological examples of columnar organization. The columnar organization was discovered in 1970 by Woolsey and Vanderloos. They noticed, this is a rendition done afterwards, but in 1970 they noticed that the arrangement of cell bodies in layer 4 looked like barrels. So that's why this is called barrel cortex. And most importantly, there's one morphological barrel corresponding to each whisker anatomically. So one of the questions that I'll talk about is whether the anatomical relationship between a single whisker and a single barrel is also a functional relationship. So this is the position of the barrel cortex on the cerebral hemisphere, and this arrangement of barrels in the tangential view is identical to the arrangement of whiskers on the rat's face. and so it's very accessible experimentally. And there's also a fairly well worked out intracortical anatomy. So the first thing that I'll talk about is work done by Justin Harris on the spatial distribution of single whisker learning. And so the question that we asked here is whether when a rat learns something with a single whisker, whether all the columns of the barrel mapper bound together as a single functional unit, or whether different areas within the map can operate independently. This was an area of interest because at the time that Justin did these experiments 2 or 3 years ago, there seemed to be a view emerging that of a globally distributed activation of somatosensory cortex, whereby it was difficult to imagine any functional independence within different parts of the map. So the question here was, if a rat learns something with one single whisker, across what territory of the cortex are the modifications associated with that whisker distributed? It is ecological for the rats to use single whiskers. They can do tasks with single whiskers. And so the design of the task was the following. Justin trained the rats to learn a task that I'll show you with a single whisker, so you can see that the other whiskers were clipped off. That's not particularly cruel because they're just hairs. So they just had a haircut on the snout, and one whisker was left, C1 in this figure. And after the rats learned the task with one whisker, they were later tested with a prosthetic whisker on a different place on the snout. So the question obviously was whether what they had previously learned with the natural whisker could then be transferred to the prosthetic whisker. In other words, could the rat have access to the learned information using a different receptor? So this required a prosthetic whisker, which means that a whisker is clipped off and then another whisker is attached with superglue. And as I'll show you, the rats actually can use the prosthetic whisker. It's a rather laborious procedure. So just to perhaps overemphasize the question, if the rat learns with a whisker whose corresponding anatomical location is at one site in the cortex, and then he's later tested with another whisker, will there be an overlap or some sort of relationship between the representation of the two whiskers that allow the rat to transfer the learning? So this is the task. The rat has one whisker. This is supposed to be a movie, but my movie program stopped working when the technician fixed my computer. And so the rat has one whisker, and he's standing, he's perched on a platform, and this is a second platform which has some regulatable distance away. And the rat needs to feel this second platform with its whisker and then jump across to get some food. So there are lots of controls that can be done here. The most important thing is this is done under red light. So we can see the rats, but albino rats evidently don't have any receptors for red. They don't have any red photoreceptors, so they act as if they're in the dark. Yes? Because they don't do this the first moment they're put into the apparatus. They have to be trained for about 4 or 5 days. So the training amounts to initially having the platforms touching one another. So all he does is, these are continuous, so he just runs down the lane and picks up his food. And then little by little, a gap is introduced and he steps over it. And then as the training progresses, the gap is large enough so that he needs to make sure that the platform is on the other side. So an important thing is that every once in a while there are catch trials introduced, and on the catch trials the target platform isn't there. So if he were to come to the edge and just jump as a reflex, he would jump into empty space and fall about this far. So well-trained rats, and they can all learn this task, they, if this platform is not there, they never step across. They always feel for it. And this is the result. So the way that these results are quantified is that complete transfer from the trained whisker to another whisker would mean it would be a value of 1.0, and total absence of transfer would be 6.25. So that the value of 6.25 comes from rats that are trained at shorter gap distances but without any whiskers at all. So they've never learned how to do the task using the whisker, and then they have a prosthetic whisker attached for the very first time, and the number of trials for them to learn to use the prosthetic whisker with no previous training is 6.25. So what's plotted here is the time, the speed with which the rat can transfer the learning as a function of the distance between the trained whisker and the new whisker, the prosthetic whisker. So the main point is that if the prosthetic whisker is put on the same whisker stub that he was previously trained with, the rats can cross almost immediately. But when the prosthetic whisker is on sites progressively more distant from the trained whisker, it takes the rat progressively longer to learn to do the task. So one step away required less learning than two steps away. And the same was true for steps along the arc.
Can you just explain what you did in the second panel here?
Oh, that means that the rat was trained with one whisker, the whisker was cut off and put back onto the same stub that he was trained with. Just to show that.
He missed one and then did it on the next one?
No, one means that he crossed on the first trial. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't put the data into the file, but when the whisker is put on the opposite side of the snout, he can show a transfer of learning that has some savings only if the new whisker is symmetric to the trained whisker. So C3 left to C3 right and so on. If it's to a non-symmetric site, the rat has to learn the task from scratch.
So in these cases, this was only one whisker on one side. This
yeah. Right. Okay, so this leads to an extremely simple hypothesis, namely that the learning, and I don't know what the learning or what the modifications are, but they're something, they're occurring in a cortical territory when the rat uses one whisker in a cortical territory that is topographically related to that whisker. There are at least two kinds of evidence. One is that if rats have an ablation of the barrel cortex, the original gap crossing study, 1986, Hudson and Masterton showed that if there's an ablation of the barrel cortex, the rats can't learn the task and they can't perform the task after they've learned. So you're thinking that doesn't show that. That doesn't distinguish between barrel cortex or some downstream side of barrel cortex, which is true. I think stronger evidence for a barrel cortex site is a study which is still unpublished, unfortunately, which shows that if the rats are trained to do the task and then receive a lesion barrel cortex, but including only the superficial layers down to layer three, then the rats can still do the task. However, if they've haven't been trained, if they receive the same lesion, a superficial lesion, before training, then they can't learn the task. Therefore, layers 4, 5, and 6 can receive and distribute information and can support the task if the rat already knows how to do it, but they can't receive and distribute the information sufficiently if the rat hasn't yet learned. So something is happening in that cortical territory during learning.
Other question.
Yeah.
What's the rat actually learning? It seems like all that's learning the deflection of the whisker tub exactly up the way the rat is doing.
Yeah, it could be. It's hard to tell what he's learning, but he could be learning to measure the distance. He could be learning that deflection of that deflection of that whisker corresponds to a platform being there. It could be a presence versus absence. Yeah, it could be some sort of.
To test the platform too, do that immediately. Or, I
mean, they do that through the shaping, through the training process. But they can learn that with their nose, for example. They can do it with their paw. Some rats prefer to feel with their paw. But then there's a distance beyond which they can't touch with their paw. They can only touch with their whisker.
Are you going to talk more about the sublation experiment?
No.
Okay, because this thing's funny. I mean, I understand your point that you're saying that you remove the upper layers, you can't get information from other somatosensory areas. Mm-hmm. But also it's hard. It also seems hard then to understand how the rat's communicating with, say, the motor area of one.
Without superficial layers?
Yeah.
Well, they have output from layer 5.
Yeah, I understand. It's
It's perhaps a simple enough task that they don't need an extremely elaborate processing in S1 in order to get an output signal from S1. But they do need something is happening in barrel cortex that requires the superficial layers in order for them to learn. So barrel cortex is part of the learning process. And of course the best demonstration would be to record activity during training. Okay, so then to continue this hypothesis, if the rat now has a new whisker, then this new whisker is projecting to some part of the barrel cortex, and if the new territory is overlapping the previously trained territory, or the territory in which the modifications occurred, and there's some territory in common, then the rat can use the previously learned information in order to facilitate relearning, and it relearns more quickly. If the new whisker is far enough away from the previous one that the cortical territories of the two whiskers are non-overlapping, then the rat shows no effect of the previous training once he's tested with the new whisker.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a very nice question. What does the barrel cortex do? Does it send a response portion to the deflection, or is it more complicated?
Much more complicated. That's probably the one thing it doesn't do. It doesn't seem to have a very strong representation of the. Some people would argue about that, but in my view, it doesn't seem to have a very strong representation of the amplitude of deflection. But it's very sensitive to the temporal characteristics of deflections.
Yeah. Basically, there's one trace in one paper that shows the sensitivity to amplitude, and then the author of that paper denies his result.
Okay. Yeah. So. So the neurons are all almost all rapidly adapting. They're sensitive to tremors, vibrations, some speeds of deflection, but that's previously has been confounded with acceleration. So we don't know how much the neurons are sensitive to the acceleration of whisker as compared to velocity. That still has to be sorted out, but not probably to position.
So you guess if you record it from a train, and then you put a pathetic whisker on, the first time you record from untrained, you see a very, very different response to go for.
Yeah, I mean, that has to be tested. So that's one reason that we're planning to implant electrodes while the rats are learning and so on. But that's a prediction. Mm-hmm.
Is the transfer time symmetric between the
points? In which sense symmetric? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's symmetric because all the groups that I showed you, if we're split into half where for some of the rats the prosthetic whisker was in front and the other half was it behind, it was up or down, all that was counterbalanced. Okay, so the second, so that's spatial distribution of single whisker learning. Then the second question is the spatial temporal distribution of whisker evoked activity. And oops, so we wanted to look for physiological correlates of this learning, and the first step was to have, since the task is a spatial, since the hypothesis depends on the spatial representation of the whiskers, we needed a physiological method that could reveal the spatial characteristics of the cortical whisker representation. So we use these 10 by 10 microelectrode arrays, which we've acquired from Utah, and then implant them in the barrel cortex. So you can see that the dimensions and the spacing of the electrodes is really ideal for this problem, because every cortical column is sampled by at least one electrode, sometimes 2 to 3 electrodes. But there's never a cortical column that's skipped over by the electrodes. So there's a sufficiently dense sampling. And the overall dimension is such that you essentially see the whole barrel cortex response when it's positioned correctly. So this is what an experiment looks like. This is an array that's implanted through the dura into the cortex, and the signals go to 100-channel amplifier, digital signal processor, and to onto the computer, and then there's a stimulus generator which sends the signal also into the computer. So one interesting feature of this method is that you can carry out upper layer recordings, middle layer, deep layer, and compare them. It's an interesting way of sampling cortical, studying cortical processing, but I'm not going to have time to talk about that. The data that I'll talk about is all from middle layers.
That's a technical question. So the cortex is curving severely at this point. So if you get a...
It's not... Yeah, I wouldn't say that they're all in the same layer. In fact, when we look at the histology, we can see some shifting across the array, but you can see that it's not curving that much.
Yeah, I just wonder what point that is. If that's the MS, is that medial lateral?
Yeah, this is medial, lateral, rostral, caudal. Okay, so I can show you. Do you guys want to see what the data look like, or? Yeah. Okay, so. So I haven't, I've really just loaded an experiment randomly, so I haven't selected the best one. I really don't know what, actually it's from an experiment that I did with David Kleinfeld's student, just by chance, so take any file. Okay, so this is, these correspond to all the electrodes. From an initial mapping, we can tell that some of the electrodes aren't in barrel cortex, so we just stop the acquisition from them. There's no point in collecting data. Let's try. Okay, so now we're seeing traces from electrode 45. I don't know what stimulus there is here. Maybe just be spontaneous activity. So every potential that you see here is stored on the computer, and then offline, at the end of the experiment, you can do a better spike sorting. So here we, just to get rid of things that are clearly artifacts, electrical artifacts, in this method we don't, you can sometimes get single units on some of the channels, but it's not a method that's geared toward single unit recording because the electrodes have low impedance. If they had a high impedance, you wouldn't get signals at all of them. So a compromise has been made between impedance and probability of getting data. Okay, so this is an example of the best possible single unit recording, but it's not common. So then the method is to deliver multiple stimulus trials to individual whiskers and then build up a PSTH on each of the channels in parallel. So here was, our PSTH is built up from 500 trials of whisker C1. So these are the raw data, and then just to make them look good, they're interpolated to give these sort of functional imaging type figures. But these are just firing rates per channel, or spikes per firing rate, spikes per trial per channel. Okay, so now we can look at some of the characteristics of the cortical representation of whiskers, such as the spatiotemporal response. Yeah. It's this inadequate stimulus, yeah. It's hard to say what a strong stimulus is, but it was adequate. And typically, neurons will respond about once per trial for a stimulus that looks like this. So the stimulus simply moves the whisker up, holds the whisker for 100 milliseconds, and releases it. And the neurons have pretty low firing rates, unless you give them high-frequency vibrations and things like that. But they're essentially just responding to the onset, and they have almost no response to the maintained stimulus. These are anesthetized urethane. So within 4 to 6 milliseconds after the stimulus, so it's a very fast relay, fast relaying system, activity begins in cortex, and I've shown the barrel, the presumed barrel for this whisker, C1. So you can see that the initial response is confined to one barrel. And then as time passes, post-stimulus time, the activity spreads out toward neighboring barrels. And this is the offset response, that is the response that occurred when the whisker was moved down. Okay, so you see the basic central and surrounding column representation. And then you can also very easily confirm the well-known topography of the barrel cortex. That is, different stimulus sites project to different parts of the barrel cortex. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if there are only 100 sites, quite a lot of interpolation. Is that hotspot, say, at C2, is that really one electrode?
This would be 1, 2, 3, and I don't know how many of the others. But these, where the grids intersect, are electrodes. So this is very clearly 3 electrodes and probably some of the others. So the average number of electrodes was, the range of electrodes was 2 to 11, typically about 6 electrodes give a statistically significant response. Okay, so one whisker is represented by one by its own central corresponding column and much less by surrounding columns. So now we can compare that a little bit to the literature, and it's consistent. It agrees with the original Woolseyan Vanderloos hypothesis, which has also been renovated and reproposed several times by Simons, namely one whisker to one column, and to some lesser extent to surrounding columns.
When you're trying to see your former colleague Mike Armstrong came, sort of made these careful maps where they looked at the latency as you get away from the central column.
Yeah.
Like sort of rings, spreading rings of activity.
Yeah.
And you had sort of sufficient data to see if your data matches with his data.
Yeah.
And so you get the spread and you get the latency effect of the spread.
Our data didn't exactly match his, but we worked on enough to understand the discrepancy. Armstrong James argued that the response to the neighboring whisker, to a non-principal whisker, is at much longer latency. And therefore, he argued that the connection that produces a surround receptive field is exclusively within the cortex. He only gave 50 trials. When you give 500 trials, the statistics allow you to see a very clear short latency response. So So within 8 to 10 milliseconds, which is short latency, probably too fast to be accounted for by intracortical pathways, activity spreads to surrounding columns. So this was something that Armstrong James didn't pick up because he didn't give quite enough trials, and also because he had a very strange latency measure, modal latency. So to the mode of the latency. So on each trial you measure the time to the first spike, build up a histogram, and the mode of that histogram was what he called latency. So all that means is that a lot of the earlier spikes you don't count as latency because they're before the mode. So we use onset latency, looking for the first bin that gives a statistically significant response. And so we found shorter latencies. We did find a similar distribution of activity. And the basic plan is the central column and the surrounding columns, which is what he found. So it agrees also with Armstrong-James, more or less. It agrees with 2-deoxyglucose experiments, where people leave rats with a single whisker and then measure glucose metabolism associated with that whisker. And agrees with immediate early gene expression, where the genes are expressed in the central column of a whisker and the surrounding whiskers. And it agrees with imaging barrel slices. It disagrees with intracellular receptive fields. Intracellular receptive fields include sometimes 10, 15, 20 whiskers, much, much more than what we've seen. Spike receptive fields are really much smaller. It doesn't agree with a concept of a globally distributed representation, whatever that might be, because we don't find that activation is globally distributed. We find that it's very topographically distributed. No. So multi-unit will be a little. So there, it's a little bit smaller because if you look at three neurons, you'll see the summation of the receptive fields, but it's not that different. Yeah, I mean EPSPs. Yeah. Okay, so then, this spatial representation of the whisker permits us to make a direct comparison now with the single whisker learning. And that's done simply by looking at the overlap between the representations of separate whiskers. So in this example, we can see three response maps, D2, C2, B2, and then these are the overlap maps, which are just the dot products between two pairs of maps, yes?
So on this graph, what would be the spread for intracellular?
What would be the spread for intracellular? Well, there's no spread. I mean, it's measured by looking at this is the spatial distribution, number of electrodes that one whisker projects to, whereas intracellular is number of whiskers that project to one cell. So it's a different measure, if you see what I mean. Okay, so if you take one electrode, like this one, this is an electrode, you could say how many whiskers project to that. And you get 4, 5, 6, something like that, in our measurements. And then, I mean, we didn't measure receptive fields because we had a different measurement. But, I mean, you could compute receptive fields from this. And they're roughly, one of my students did that, and they're roughly 4 or 5 whiskers. In EPSP receptive fields are 15, 20 whiskers. Pardon me? Yeah. I mean, you mean extracellular or intracellular?
Intracellular,
some neurons receive input from every whisker. EPSPs are evoked by every whisker for some neurons. So so clearly you can see that the overlap between adjacent whiskers in cortex is larger than the overlap between more distant whiskers. So then the point was to quantify that by measuring the overlap between many, many pairs of whiskers.
That overlap was computed by integrating over time.
Yeah, this was over the whole response for about 40 or 50 milliseconds.
Is that going to make a difference if you look at short time wavelength?
Yeah, if you look at a short time, then you'll see less overlap. If you look at 6 milliseconds, you'll see almost no overlap because each whisker projects only to its own cortical column. So this was, I think, about 40 or 50 milliseconds, so it's the overlap for the entire response period.
The overlap is actually dominated by the long
latency. Yeah, I mean, long in the sense of greater than 10 milliseconds. It's not long in the sense of 30, 40 milliseconds. In fact, almost always the response begins to decay after about 15 milliseconds. Okay, so now the point was to compute these averaged over many, many pairs of whiskers and then compare to the transfer of learning. And this is the answer. This is supposed to be black. So this is the blue. The blue bars show the overlap between the cortical response patterns for pairs of whiskers separated by a given distance. And the gray, which is actually black, shows the transfer of learning speed for whiskers separated by the same distance. So this is behavioral data, and this is physiological data. And the correlation is very high, meaning that if you know the spatial relationship between the cortical representation of two whiskers, the barrel cortex representation, you can predict very, very reliably how quickly the rats could transfer their learning from two whiskers at that same position. This is spike squared per stimulus squared, because it's a dot product. Spikes per stimulus times spikes per stimulus.
I don't know if you have enough precision to answer this question, but do you think you can distinguish the overlap precision as a function of the number of barrels between the two points or the distance in the millimeters of the cord? Because it seems that different barrels occupy different space, different size of the cord.
Well, these are not nearest neighbors. I mean, these are two steps. So this was, for example, C1 versus C3. So they're two steps away, and there's behavioral data for this relationship and physiological data. So I mean, the relative whisker positions are known.
What I'm trying to say, I'm not very clear, but there seems to be a difference, for example, between rho plus 1 and r plus 1.
Mm-hmm.
And if the transfer to rho plus 1 is greater,
yeah,
does that correspond to the fact that in the cortex, the distance between two neighboring rows is smaller than the distance between two neighboring r's, or not?
No. No, that it corresponds. It's, no, I don't think so. I mean, one of the strong points, I think, in this data is that for rho plus 1, the transfer of learning and the overlap was better, higher than rho plus 2. Arc plus 1, as one step along the arc, was better than two steps along the arc. And rho plus 1 showed better transfer and higher overlap than arc plus 1. And rho plus 2 better than arc plus 2. So these nuances in the rho and arc representations were duplicated both in the behavior and in the...
Do you think that corresponds to the difference in the distance
of
the cortex between two rows and two
arcs?
No, I don't know, because the... Yeah, I mean, some people say that. There's some evidence for slightly stronger intracortical connectivity along a row. this set paper with Wolsey, Bernardo and Wolsey. So there are probably two papers from the same lab, I mean the same experiment done a couple of times, showing that there's a slightly stronger horizontal connectivity for columns along a row than along an arc. No, the axons spread a little bit more along a row of columns than along an arc of columns.
So that's how you just understand the data. Now, yeah. E is essentially the control level.
Yeah.
So arc plus 2 is very close to the control level. So
yeah. In fact, if the whisker was moved 2 steps away, the rat had to relearn the task.
The difference between rat plus 1 and arc plus 1 is 6.
I think this one wasn't. No, I don't. I think that there was just a tendency for that, but I don't think that was statistically significant.
But basically, we have three non-trivial points.
Or
plus one, or plus two.
Yeah. Yeah. So the measured statistically, the rats show a savings in retraining. They show a savings in when they're retested only if the whisker is put on the same site or one of the immediately surrounding sites. If it's placed on a site that's 2 steps away, the rats statistically measured had to relearn from scratch. They weren't different from naive. Okay, so this was consistent, I think, with this rather crude hypothesis. And that was actually the experiment that inspired the project with fingertips, which we may get to later. I don't know how the time will be going. But.
Well, let me just say something simple. Suppose I didn't know from all these horizontal connection papers, but if you look at sort of the spread of dendrites in the column, you drew things sort of as a cylinder, but maybe a conic is a little more appropriate. And it's basically that. Sort of Misha's point, you have sort of significant transfer to the nearest neighbor. So I mean, it's just the overlap of dendritic branches in the upper or lower layers could be enough, right? To spread the information.
Could be. Yeah. I don't know exactly what anatomical structures are accounting for the distribution of information. I don't know.
But it almost seems like against transfer from horizontal connections, because the anatomy papers show horizontal, upper layer 2-3 connections running, many, up 3-4, if I remember the paper, the heart. And you're saying you don't get transfer of learning on the scale at which you see horizontal connections run.
Well, with horizontal connections, there's a thresholding issue, because if your criterion is a few axons spreading or a few dendrites, you can see some that spread a long way. If you require a lot to be counted as real connectivity, then they don't spread very far. Really, it's a thresholding problem. Even in the Bernardo and Wolsey papers, they use this thresholding method to measure the density. And if you use a low threshold, you can see really widespread. I mean, the intracellular, the EPSP receptive fields show that there's some anatomical structure that permits an integration of almost all whiskers by one neuron. So some connectivity exists and some connectivity can permit the arrival of information. But I guess the question is, how is the rat using this connectivity? So then, so then the issue is that.
It's by cutting all of the whiskers that you can kill. But in the normal situation, all of the whiskers are actually.
It could be.
You think it's suppressing it?
It could be, but
then you go in and, sort of give the rat a little massage every day, right?
But. Dan Simons argues that the main functional significance of the connectivity is inhibitory. He says that one whisker is mainly has an inhibitory influence on the neighboring columns. That's true. That's true. But that it's hard to control the inputs in those circumstances. But yeah, that's the more natural way to do it.
Well, I mean, also, wouldn't you argue, based on your own work, that you have cortex feeding back to posterior medial thalamus, which then feeds back to cortex, and that leads to effectively to a lateral spread?
It may be the spread between to neighboring columns. I mean, that may be as far as the spread is. So since the issue here was the discrimination, the how the cortical population represents two separate whiskers, we carried out two different studies of the cortical discriminability of the single whisker inputs. The first was a population approach, and then the second was information. Sorry. So the population approach was just D prime, and I think that people here, I think people here know what D prime is. It's a measurement of the distance between two distributions divided or in some way normalized by the variability. So so this is D prime is the difference between the means divided by variability, and then for population, so for our population, the mean is the activity at each electrode, and so we just summate over electrodes to have a population discriminability. God, it's been a long time. What is C? C is the stimulus. A channel is an electrode. Yeah, and B is a bin because we moved across in time to measure the discriminability in the cortical population as a function of time.
How big is a
bin? They're in 20 milliseconds, moved in 5 millisecond steps. And this is the answer. This is D prime squared for technical reasons, and so you can see that in spontaneous activity, well, there's no discriminability. Then there's a very, very sharp rise in how well this cortical population discriminates between the two different inputs. These are neighboring whiskers, either in a row or an arc, and this is as a function of the distance between the two whiskers. So I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but the only thing that I want to mention is that the population discriminability is very, very, very fast. So this is within 10 milliseconds, the cortical response patterns were very different for different whiskers. So it's an extremely fast system, which could be a benefit for the animal if it's trying to guide its behavior based on what whisker has touched something. And within this fast, within this short interval, cortical neurons would only have fired probably one or at most two spikes. So it's a representation that's based on single neurons firing very few spikes. Did I say what? This wasn't any task. It was just the same physiological data analyzed for D prime. It's just a 100 electrode recording where different whiskers are stimulated, single whiskers, and then looking at the cortical response pattern, you estimate how different the pattern for the different whiskers is, how discriminable.
So if they compare this to this transfer of learning study, it seems that there is an inverse correlation, right? So better the transfer of learning towards the
Right, so in a sense, maybe the rat can transfer the learning because he doesn't realize that the new whisker is in a different position.
But it also seems to apply for O and
R. Yeah. Yeah. So he's right. Okay, so good. David's gone, so I can talk about information. So then the next analysis of discriminability was an information one. This was done by Stefano Panzeri, who's Alessandro's student from, I guess, 1996 was his PhD, together with Rasmus Peterson, who works with me. So the approach is just to look at here, I should explain the method a little bit. Here we didn't use the 100 electrode arrays because we aren't extremely confident about the discriminability between spikes. So we used an array of individual electrodes where we had much better spike separation. So this is based on single units, not clusters. And the point is to give a single whisker stimulus a number of times, 50, 60 times. Here I've shown it 10 times. And so you know that individual whiskers will produce patterns of spikes that differ. So if this is a C2 neuron, from everything I've said so far, you'd know, first of all, that the stimulus D2, C2, will produce more spikes than stimuli C1 or C3. And you also know that the spikes occur faster, the latency is shorter. So, of course, the informational approach is, if you see these spikes on one trial, how well could you determine which whisker had been touched? And the answer is C2, both because there are two spikes, and we know that, Right, so if there are two spikes, it was more likely to be the central whisker than one of the neighboring whiskers.
Are you assuming that you know when contact occurred?
Yes, so for what I'm talking about now, we have information that the rat doesn't have. And I can talk a little bit later about the interpretation of that. So we know the stimulus time, so we know also that this spike occurred at short latency, which for us can be informative. So the question is, if the rat doesn't know when the stimulus occurred, can it still use latency? And that's a whole different problem that we're working on a lot now, sort of a clock-free information method. But yeah, we're working.
It probably really requires population.
Pardon me?
It probably really requires population,
especially
yeah.
Going up.
Yeah, it requires. Yeah, I mean, it requires populations. We use, but we can do it with a population of 100 extremely reliably without knowing the stimulus time. But actually, the fact that there are very few spikes per trial is very useful for that, because it makes it easier to look for a template of the response as compared to background activity. So yeah, the short answer is that we use latency information. So the point is that we could characterize this response both from the number of spikes and also try to use the timing of the spikes. And I think you know this. So this spike chain informational approach was done by Stefano and Rasmus. This is Rasmus surprised while working. So you guys haven't. This was a Photoshop fabrication that was maliciously distributed around the department. Okay, so what we did, and we means, again, not me, it means Stefan and Rasmus. What we did is try to figure out the time scale across which the information is represented, asking whether information is fully represented using a large time scale in number of spikes per trial, or is better represented using a finer time scale. And also, we've asked what is the unit for the representation of information, by comparing how reliably information is represented if you consider pairs of neurons compared to individual neurons. So to compare information in counts to information using better temporal precision, we compare a spike count we compare spike counts, where these would be the values over a set of trials, to information, to spikes that are binned in time, and so we have little words of 100 or 01000 on each trial, and then find out whether there's a better, more reliable representation of the stimulus site using the information finer time bins. Right, so again, of course, the key question is, what is the stimulus set? So here we're asking the same question. We recognize that it's not perhaps the most sophisticated question in barrel cortex, what whisker was touched. But we know, first of all, that it's behaviorally important for the rat, and it's also the simplest thing that we can ask. So if we can get a handle on the nature of the information representation with an extremely simple stimulus, then we can have hypotheses for testing more complicated stimuli. But I think it would be disastrous to do an information analysis on a stimulus that we don't really understand. So we've asked so the stimulus set is 9 different whiskers, and we've asked neurons which whisker was stimulated. And the Stefano Panzeri did this analysis of information, and I'm not a mathematician, so I can't give you the details of it, but Alessandro understands it. So if you have questions about the method, ask Alessandro or look at the paper, which I brought with me. So this is an expansion of the total information into different terms, a first order term and second order terms. And I think that the usefulness of this expansion is that the different terms correspond to functionally different parts of the neuronal signal. IT, the first term, is the information in the timing of independent spikes. The second term, the first second order term, is the information in PSTH similarity, which is a correction. It's always negative. It's a correction for the information, for the redundancy that would occur from correlated spikes within a PSTH. This term, ITTB, is the stimulus-independent spike patterns, and the last term is stimulus-dependent spike patterns. So, pardon me?
Why isn't ITTB zero if it's stimulus-independent?
It can be zero.
Well, why isn't it always zero?
Because there can be stimulus-independent spike patterns.
They can. Stimulus-independent spike patterns doesn't have any information.
It can. No, but it's those terms are neglected, because according to Stefano, those for if certain conditions are met in the data set, those terms are not important, so they're ignored.
These three last terms would be much less than the first one.
Yeah, they turn out to be much less. Right, so these are individual spike terms, and these are spike pattern terms. Okay, so we asked first about the time scale. So these are the PSTHs for one neuron for 9 different whiskers. And then the question is, how much information is there in the spike count? So this information is cumulative information by looking from 0 to here, 0 to here, 0 to here, right? So it's from progressively longer windows. And you can see that the information in the total spike count increases over time and remains quite high, because the total spike count is highest for the central whisker. So here the maximum information for 9 whiskers is, I guess, about 3.2. Right. No, it's not D2 against the rest of the world, it's which one. So the maximum information is 3.2, I think. And in spike timing, the amount of information was about the same. So when the spike chain was divided into bins, there wasn't that much additional information. But for another neuron, I think this was 10 millisecond bins. So here, for this neuron, it was different because initially there was a significant amount of information in spike count, because if you look at the spike count up to here, there are spikes only for one whisker and not for the other whiskers. So initially, spike count is informative, but then as the time window expands, spike count becomes less informative because the other whiskers begin to produce spikes. So if you look across the whole window, then the information in the spike count was almost negligible. But the information from in spike timing remained, grew over time, because you have these information in the words of 1000 versus 001, etc. Okay, so this is the for a population of about 100 neurons in D2, and for almost all the neurons, this is the amount of information in the spike count for each neuron. This is the additional information in timing, and the scale is the same. So you can see that for the majority of neurons, there was some additional information by taking into account the spike timing. On average, it was 44%. I don't think this is on. It is? Okay. I didn't turn it on. I guess the guy who gave it to me turned it on. Okay. Right, so on average. Pardon me?
When you do these spike count versus timing, you tend to sort of. There's not quite bias in the information.
There's bias. It was corrected for bias. Yeah. So on average, there's about a 44% advantage by using spike timing. Right, so then the next question is how fine is the spike timing that contributes this information? And the answer is that when you look at progressively smaller bins, the information rises. And so so there's some spike precision up to at least 2.5 milliseconds.
Do you have measurements or sense when the rats rub against an object what the timing is between when different whiskers hit?
No. I mean, I can guess, but I mean, you would have to. Yeah. But I mean, I can guess just from, you know, sort of calculations of whisking speed and so on, but I mean, you would have the evidence.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem it's around, it's 2 milliseconds.
Yeah.
It seems like that's a strong result.
Okay, so then having found that there's information in the spike timing, the method, this series expansion, allows us to see what component of the timing is carrying information. And these, for this we look not at single neurons, but at pairs of neurons. These are for two neurons, both of which were in D2. Yeah, simultaneously. And the result is that there's much more information in the timing of individual spikes than in the patterns, than in the spike patterns for the two neurons. These are for two neurons in two neighboring columns and two neurons in columns separated by one. And for all the pairs of neurons, there was, in general, more information in individual spikes than there was in the spike patterns. So then the next question is, what sort of information is it in the patterns? So of the patterns, two kinds of patterns can exist: cross-cell spike patterns and individual cell spike patterns. So cross-cell spike patterns could be something like synchrony, as an example, and within cell spike patterns could be something like a refractory period where the neuron fires one spike And if it's fired one, if it's fired one spike, it's very unlikely to fire a spike in the next bin. So it would tend to have a 1-0 pattern. See if there's any result here. Okay. So this is for the pairs in different locations, and the answer is that all the information in patterns was within single cell patterns. The relative timing of the spikes among pairs of neurons contributed no information. So it's not a result that's strongly supporting a view of synergy. In other words, there's no synergy would have, the finding of synergy would have been a significant quantity of information in cross-cell spike patterns, and that didn't exist in this data set. So I talked earlier about the discriminability in cortical patterns existing very, very shortly after the stimulus. And argued that within 10 milliseconds, when cortical response patterns are highly discriminable, neurons probably would have fired at most one spike, possibly two spikes. So that gives us, that raises the question of whether the different spikes within a sequence are equally informative, or whether there are differences in the quantity of information. So if we look at all of the spikes in the spike train, we see this isn't much information. But if we only take the first spike and delete any second or third spikes that occur, there's almost as much information. Second and third spikes alone are much less informative. So to summarize, and we tried to take that into account, and it's not simple to do that. But even if you look at information per spike, then the result is similar. So it's a combination of the fact that the second and third spikes occur more rarely, and when they do occur, they're less informative. So to summarize, spike timing is carrying information, about 44%. Precision is about 2.5 milliseconds. Individual spikes carry 83% of the information in our data set. Within cell spike pattern, 17%, and cross cell synergy, almost nothing. And the first spikes in the response are carrying the lion's share of information. So to summarize, the population code is a distributed sequence of first spike times.
No, it's about the first 26.
What? Pardon me?
First 46.
43% more information available in spike timing. And which is the sixth one? First spikes?
First spike is only characterized by its timing.
Right, so that's...
So this is fewer than timing.
It's what?
It's only the time.
Which is informative.
Right, but you say only 43% is in spike.
No, 43% more additional is in spike timing.
More
than in counts. It's 44% more than in the count. It's not 44% of the total. I mean, all the information is in timing. Because that's all, I mean, it doesn't get rid of anything. Okay, so this was an oversimplified data set, but at least it gives us some ideas to test now with more complicated stimuli, more natural stimuli, whisker sequences, and things like that. So, yeah, it does. So there are two. Okay, so the question is, does the rat know when the stimulus has occurred? I mean, we know because... So there's one possible way that the rat could know, which is from if most of the stimuli that the rat encounters, it creates itself by whisker movement, then it could know when stimuli have occurred by knowing its own motor output. Right? So. Yeah, but he. So if he produces most of his own stimuli by moving the whisker forward, then he could, in a sense, begin a trial by the timing of the start of the whisker movement. So that wouldn't give you 2 millisecond.
How does it know when the whisker will be?
No, but it knows where the whisker is. So it's also, it's a reference signal for where the whisker is.
Yeah.
So the opening should have the two are combined.
Yeah. So the answer is that we probably. Yeah, exactly. So this could. It's trying to do it on single whisks.
No, averaging over many cells to get a reference. That was the output many cells. It's a little more accurate than the reference.
Right. So another possibility is that it doesn't have enough information from its own output signal. And in that case, it would probably have to rely on cross-cell timing, right? So we, a little bit, would shoot ourselves in the foot because we argued that there wasn't that much information in.
You argued that there's not much information in the stimulus.
Right, right. If you know when the stimulus occurs, then you don't. There's not that much extra information. There's no extra information in relative spike timing. But if you don't know when the stimulus occurred, if the rat doesn't know, then it may in fact have to. It may in fact rely on relative spike timing. So that's what we're testing now. So we're making templates of responses and then fitting templates and so on. So why don't we have a break now and then?
Okay, so why don't we meet back in 15 minutes?
So in the second part of this presentation, I'll talk about people. And the experiments in people were motivated by this very simple hypothesis that we formed from the rats. Namely that when the rat learns something with one whisker, effectively the information that's stored during learning has a topographic distribution dictated by the position of that whisker in the somatosensory map. And that subsequently, when the rat has to express the learning with a different whisker, its ability to do that depends on the spatial relationship between the two whiskers. So it was very natural to wonder whether there's anything like that operating with our own whiskers, namely with our fingertips. So we simply asked to what extent the transfer of information, to what extent the information learned through one fingertip is accessible using different fingers. And the goal is, of course, to find out whether, in fact, humans are a good experimental model for the rats. Yeah.
Can you just explain sort of the spatial relationship between different fingers and cortex?
Yeah, that's going to be the central point of the talk. It turns out that the spatial relationship between fingers depends on which cortical map you look at. And what we found out, the bottom line of the story will be that different sorts of learning seem to occur within different kinds of maps. And the sharing of information between fingertips depends exactly on the task. And each kind of, each pattern of sharing, task-dependent pattern of sharing, can be explained by one of the several cortical maps. So a little bit at a time, I'll explain the finger representation in cortical maps. But just to give you a preview, in the first processing area, area 3B, there's a very sharp distinction in the representation of each fingertip. It's both based on primate physiology and human fMRI. There are several strips within primary somatosensory cortex that represent different sorts of receptors. So in area 3B, where rapidly adapting vibration-sensitive receptors are represented, there's a very sharp topographic map. Therefore, the information from each fingertip is separated, which leads to a prediction. Information from S1 is projected to S2, where the maps are less sharp, and there's, in fact, an integration between the two sides of the body. So there hadn't been much work on this problem. There'd been very little work in somatosensory system, but there had been previously work in visual system on the same sort of a problem. Namely, if you learn something about a visual stimulus that's been presented to only one part of the visual field, and then you're tested in which you have to make some judgment about the same stimulus but presented to a different part of the visual field, then you, from in the data that's been collected so far, people show a specificity, a visual field specificity, suggesting that that the learning in fact was restricted to the cortical network dealing with one part of the visual field and wasn't shared with the rest of the visual field.
Now, it depends a lot on what you're asking the subject to do.
In the visual system. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And there's a role of task difficulty and so on. And they're extremely difficult in artificial experiments because it's not natural to stare for an hour at one point and have a stimulus presented at another point. So it was rather unnatural. And
all of visual physiology is done?
Yeah, visual psychophysics, yeah. So whereas in the tactile system, it's more natural to use fingers separately. So the design was the same as the one in the whiskers. People learned something with one fingertip and then they were tested with other fingertips. The terminology will, I think in all the slides, if I haven't screwed up, the terminology will be that the trained fingertip is called T. Then on the same side of the hand, the two neighbors are T1 and T2. Then the opposite fingertip to the trained one is called C, contralateral. And then contralateral 1 and 2 are the neighbors of the symmetric fingertip. And the question is how much is transferred. So we use different tasks. In the first task, people were trained over the course of about an hour. So this is rather quick, rather fast sensory learning, perceptual learning, 45 minutes more or less. People were trained to identify with their fingertip one of two different sandpapers. And when their performance with one fingertip reached a criterion of about 80%, I think, they were then tested. What? It's a pizza? Where do you eat your pizza? Remind me not to go there.
The scale is not 400.
400 microns it's supposed to be, I think. I think I changed font and the microns turned to meters. And this is the answer. When people were tested, of course they were retested with a trained fingertip and they performed very well, the same as they had done at the end of the training session. And they performed above chance with the neighboring fingertip and with the opposite fingertip. But with the other fingertips, their performance was not significantly different from baseline. So they, and according to a statistical criterion, they showed no effect of the previous training. So the short message is that the tactile learning for this task is within some sort of a topographic framework.
Why is baseline 65%?
Because even before training, people can distinguish between the two stimuli.
Is there any difference in saturating performance levels of different fingers?
Not systematic. Nothing we could tell systematically. We had hypotheses about index finger and things like that, but nothing came out of it.
Okay.
people usually use one finger.
Yeah.
One or two, you know, these two fingers.
It seemed like there's, we have the feeling that there's a trade-off because people tend to use more often than not their index finger for discriminations. So you might expect a better performance, but it turns out that their thin skin is thicker. It's more calloused from being used. So you lose, you gain the training performance, but lose the sensitivity. So we wanted to make certain that people weren't performing better with a trained fingertip just from having focused their attention on that and learned to focus their attention. So we trained people with two surfaces and then tested them with two other surfaces. And they were no better with the trained fingertip than with other fingertips. So they hadn't learned, they hadn't simply focused their attention on the trained fingertip. In fact, what they had learned was specific to the discriminanda.
Well, what is my...
Pardon me?
What do you mean by two different surfaces? What does that mean?
So there's...
Different brands of sandpaper?
So there are grades of sandpaper. There are four different grades of sandpaper. So they're trained on, let's say, A versus B. And with one fingertip, they reach a criterion for A versus B. And then they're tested with C versus D.
Yeah, but what's different about A and B?
Oh, it's the... Oh, I'm going the wrong way. It's the size of the grains and the spacing between the grains. I mean, they feel different. That's all we care about. I mean, that's what people subjectively classify them as.
So you've got A and B, which are near each other, but both of them are kind of rough.
Yeah.
One smoother than the other.
Yeah.
C and D
are nearer to each other.
Are smoother, but also different.
Right. Exactly.
Okay,
so if people were trained on C versus D, they could learn that discrimination as well as they could learn A versus B. So it's not that they're just, it was just an impossible discrimination. The C versus D was as equally as discriminable with training as A versus B.
Okay, but A, B, C, and D are arrayed along the dimension.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Then another task was pressure discrimination. So for that we used microfilaments, which are called von Frey hairs, or von Frey filaments for specialists in the tactile system. And the thickness of the filament determines the pressure that it exerts. And they exert pressure as you apply it to the skin, and then the thickness determines the bending and so on. And initially, it's hard to tell one versus the other. So people are trained to make that discrimination, and then they are tested for the transfer, and the distribution was much like the distribution for the roughness discrimination. Namely, people did well with the trained fingertip. They did well with the neighbor and with the opposite fingertip, but not with the second neighbors on either side. So again, the information seemed to be distributed within some sort of a map. It wasn't globally distributed. Third task was vibration discrimination. People learned to discriminate between two regular square wave vibrations, which were either at 18 hertz or 20 hertz. And they learned to call them slow or fast. And when they reached criterion with one fingertip, they're retested with that and with the neighboring fingertips. And here there is, again, a map-like distribution, but it was distinctly different from the previous sorts of discriminanda. Because here, people showed an effect of the training only with the same fingertip that they'd been trained with. With the other fingertips, they were never significantly different from baseline. So there's no effect of training except with the single fingertip.
Well, this looks also the more difficult stuff.
Yeah. It was slightly more difficult. It took more trials to learn.
So
you're thinking like Ahisar and Hochstein?
Well, you didn't normalize the difficulty of the past. so that the correct, so that the asymptotic performance is the same.
Yeah, the performance was the same. The threshold was the same, actually. It was at 80%. They were all at 80%. Because it took more trials to get 50%. Especially because there's evidence from Ahisar and Hochstein that that more difficult sensory tasks have a more focalized representation from in visual system. So task difficulty is maybe a factor in this, actually.
Isn't that the whole point of task difficulty?
It's not the whole point. I mean. So my argument would be that what's different is the cortical area in which the information is stored. That's going to be my point.
The diversion test seems close to the tests that were reported on by Mountcastle and Baron Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any comment you can make on each? They had a slightly different path of discrimination. They give a stimulus at one frequency and you had to go up. Is there some correspondence between your data and this data from the 70s from Mountcastle?
Well, that was a comparison task, and this is a recognition task, because on each trial they receive only one stimulus. They don't receive one stimulus and a comparison stimulus. They receive only one stimulus. That's one reason it's very difficult, because recognition tasks are always more difficult than comparison tasks. So the frequencies here were, I think, 20 and 18. And if you ask someone to compare, which will be the second part of the talk, if you ask someone to compare 20 to 18 receives successively, they perform better, they perform well without any training. But what's difficult is to form a representation that can be where you can compare each individual stimulus to the stored representation, a recognition task.
Sorry, but this just made me realize I wasn't sure I understood exactly what the task is here. The person has to just feel a vibration and tell you whether it's A or B.
Mm-hmm. Faster, slower.
So they have an internal. They have to have an internal representation.
They have to build up an internal
representation.
So
it's not. No. They only receive it once to know.
On each trial. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then. So how to account for the differences? Task difficulty might be one complicating factor, but we have to consider that for two of the tasks, the roughness discrimination and the pressure discrimination, the difficulty was a little bit, they were different, and yet the distribution. It took more trials for people to learn pressure discrimination that took them to learn roughness discrimination. And if there is a simple relationship between difficulty and distribution, you would have expected that to show in performance, and yet they had the same distributions. So that's not the only factor.
Okay. Sorry. How do you take the baseline then? If there's only one stimulus, do you tell them that there's going to be a high frequency and a low frequency stimulus?
The baseline is performance over the first 20 trials.
But the person's totally naive.
You give them a
vibration, and they're supposed to tell you whether it's higher or lower, but they've never felt it.
No. The very first few trials, they're presented with both of them, told what they are, and then they have 20 trials.
So there is an initial brief training period.
Yeah. Right. Now sandpaper is, you don't have much control over it. So that's one reason that we now all we use in any psychophysics is vibration. Why? Because we can write a LabVIEW program that does what we want. So the So what is the interpretation? So we compared the distributions to what's known about different somatosensory cortical areas. In area 3B, neurons have single-digit receptive fields. Neurons never receive input from multiple digits, and which is consistent with our finding in vibration learning that there's no transfer to neighboring fingertips. And there's no corpus callosum connection between the two area 3Bs on the opposite sides of the hemisphere, which is consistent with the absence of transfer to the opposite hand. Furthermore, it's known that this is shown as a human brain and human hand, but it's actually, the data actually come from monkeys. It's known that during training in vibration discriminations, the neuronal representation of the vibration becomes sharper, from Re Canzone's work, and the cortical representation expands. So there's physiological evidence consistent with vibration learning being area 3B. As to the other kinds of learning, the slowly adapting neuronal types have single-digit receptive fields, and so it's unlikely to mediate a transfer to neighboring fingertips, and the absence of corpus callosum is unlikely to mediate a transfer of learning to the opposite hand. So we wouldn't expect area 3B or other S1 areas to mediate the transfer of roughness and pressure learning. And neither area 2, but all this are details for somatosensory people. On the other hand, the second somatosensory cortical area, S2, neurons have multiple digit receptive fields and strong corpus callosum connections. It's known that lesions in this area disrupt the learning of roughness discrimination. And many neurons in physiological experiments have categorical responses to different roughnesses, which would be a good characteristic of neurons. And in humans, in fMRI, there's evidence for S2 activation during roughness discrimination. So to summarize, we think that some essential component of frequency of vibration learning is in S1, probably in area 3B, whereas in contrast, the essential component of roughness and pressure learning appears to be in a different cortical area. So the main result that we had here, the main concept, is that the somatosensory cortical processing areas that are known to represent stimuli online during the presentation of the stimulus seem to be the same cortical areas that store information, much like we argued occurred in barrel cortex. And so we wanted to expand this idea to see whether these same cortical areas stored information not only over longer periods of time, but also during brief periods of time. Yes? Well, I mean, the idea is that if the neurons that are being modified during training are neurons that respond to only one fingertip, and neurons that respond to a neighboring fingertip receive no input during training and are therefore not involved in learning, then there'd be no possibility within that cortical area for a sharing of the information, because the neurons from the second fingertip would have not received any input. Well, we, no, the idea of the connections is, if there are connections, then this would be evident in their receptive fields. I mean, the absence of multi-digit receptive fields is evidence for absence of connectivity. Connectivity and receptive fields go hand in hand, if you'll excuse the pun. So we wanted to broaden this inquiry to see if not only see whether sensory information is stored there, stored in primary somatosensory cortex, not only during learning, but also during for shorter periods of time. And the most important task that comes to mind is a working memory task. In a working memory task, someone receives some information, a sensory working memory task. They receive some sensory information and then have to hold on to that information in order, for some brief period of time, usually a question of seconds, in order to act on the information, to use the information for a comparison, and then make a decision based on that information a short time later. And losing the information will cause them to not be able to carry out the task. The neuronal substrates of working memory are known to include prefrontal cortex, where there's a so-called central executive mechanism that controls attention and monitors and manipulates sensory information, posterior association cortex, and then what we wanted to find out is whether in the same working memory circuitry, sensory cortex itself is involved. There is some evidence for sensory cortex. Lesioning sensory cortex impedes sensory working memory, but that's perhaps not very informative because any cortical area that depended on sensory cortex would lose its input. So that's consistent, but not very convincing. There's some very weak brain imaging evidence that sensory cortex is active during working memory, but the temporal sequences have been difficult to work out because of the constraints of functional imaging. So it's hard to tell whether the activation is during the presentation of the stimulus or the storage of the stimulus. In electrophysiology in monkeys, there's been some very preliminary evidence for neurons that are active during delay periods, during working memory tasks in visual cortex and somatosensory cortex. But our approach was to use what we had now become used to, which was to use the topographical distribution of information as a probe for the cortical area that's involved. And then we supplemented that recently with a transcranial magnetic stimulation experiment. So this is a device to deliver vibrations to any pair of fingertips, excluding the thumb because that was hard to work out. But any of the eight fingertips can receive a vibration. These gray strips are piezoelectric wafers that receive a voltage from an amplifier which is driven by a computer. So from the computer program, we can determine the frequency of the vibration, any temporal characteristic of the vibration, which fingertips will receive the two stimuli, and the delay between the two stimuli. So now the task is not to learn with one fingertip and then be tested with others, but rather to receive a stimulus on one fingertip and then to compare it to a stimulus that's delivered after a brief delay either to that same fingertip or to other fingertips. The retention interval was 400 milliseconds, 1 second, or 2 seconds. And this is the first result. The discrimination was, I think, 18 versus 20. Yeah, it was 18 versus 20 hertz. It was a 2 hertz difference in the range of 18 to 26, actually. So in any given trial, it could be 18 versus 20, 20 versus 22, 24 versus 26, and so on. And what the person had to say at the end of the trial was high, low, or low, high. So this is not a recognition, it's a comparison task. There's one stimulus that lasts 1 second, then a delay of either 400 milliseconds, 1 second, or 2 seconds, and then a second stimulus of 1 second, which was either higher or lower in frequency and delivered either to the same fingertip or to a different fingertip. And when the stimulus, when both stimuli are delivered on the same fingertip, people perform very well at short intervals. But for the same short interval, people perform much less well when the vibrations are delivered to any other combination of fingertips. So the bottom line here is that for a short interval, there's a very sharp topography. People can make this, can make a comparison between two stimuli, make a comparison reliably only if the two stimuli are delivered to the same fingertip. As the interval, the error bars were quite small. I didn't show them here. I mean, this was significantly different from all. No, the performance was above chance only for same fingertip. No, naive subjects, no training. No, because from the previous work we think the training is finger specific, and here they received all different combinations as well as all different frequencies within a range, and so they never had enough repetitions to learn. So for a short interval, the working memory is topographically specific, arguing that an essential component of working memory trace was in a sharply topographic cortical area, probably area 3B. As the interval increased, the working memory became less sharply topographic, and in fact, for a 1 second interval, people could make comparisons not only on the same fingertip, but also between opposite fingertips, right? So like index finger to index finger. At a 2 second interval, people could, now, I'm sorry, I don't have the significance values here, but I remember that now all of these are significant. So at 2 seconds, people were, first of all, equally good in comparisons across the two hands, and they're good for neighboring stimuli, for neighboring fingertips. So there's a blurring of the topography across time. So now we performed a direct comparison for across the retention interval for two stimuli in the same fingertip versus two stimuli on opposite fingertips. And for an interval of 300 or 600 milliseconds, people are above chance only for two stimuli in the same fingertip and not for... This is a comparison between these two, not between chance. So people are better for the same finger than the opposite fingertip for short intervals, but for the longer intervals, there's no difference between comparing two stimuli in the same fingertip versus two stimuli in the opposite fingertip.
These are all above chance.
I think so. I'm sorry, I can't remember. I have to check my paper. Sorry. Okay, so the idea is that for very short intervals of working memory, the information is stored in a sharply topographic, a finely topographic area, such as area 3B. But over longer intervals, the information is stored in some area where the topography is less fine. In fact, that there's a sharing across the two hands, probably S2. So we tested that by delivering a magnetic stimulus to a site that we tried to identify as S1 cortex, and finding out whether that interfered with working memory. Do you guys know what TMS is?
Maybe spend a minute or two.
Can spend less than a minute, because I don't know a minute's worth of it. that TMS is, so these are magnetic coils, and it produces a pulse, a magnetic pulse, which has the effect in the underlying tissue of producing a synchronous volley in cortex, followed by an after hyperpolarization. So TMS has been used mainly in prefrontal cortex, and the idea of it is that any activity that's ongoing, that's part of some ongoing neuronal processing, would be interrupted and replaced by a synchronous volley in a period of several hundred milliseconds without any activity, because there seems to be a long after hyperpolarization or inhibitory volley or something like that. So any neuronal firing pattern that's information bearing would be interrupted, replaced, and canceled and erased. Whereas usually people use trains of stimuli, which are more effective, we use the single pulse because we want to have a better control of the timing. So we had people compare two stimuli on the same fingertip, which, because we think that, okay, and then we delivered the TMS either early in the interval or late in the interval. So the prediction would be, since we know that the topography is very sharp early in the interval, we predicted that TMS delivered at this point would, on somatosensory cortex, would interfere with the working memory, because we believe that the activity in S1 shortly after the delivery of the stimulus is an essential component of the memory trace. But since the topography spreads out over time, suggesting a subsequent processing in some other cortical area, we predicted that TMS delivered late in the interval would not interfere with the working memory. And then the controls to the contralateral stimulus were midline and ipsilateral, neither of which had any effect. So in fact, this was baseline performance, about 80%, and ipsilateral TMS had no effect at any time in the interval, as predicted. Whereas contralateral TMS, contralateral to the fingertip stimulus site, diminished performance when it was early and a little bit later during the delay interval, but had no significant effect during the later parts of the interval. Therefore, interfering with primary somatosensory cortical activity immediately after the first stimulus diminishes the working memory, but subsequent stimulation has no effect. It's as if the working memory trace has migrated out of S1 later. So we think that when people receive a tactile stimulus and then have to hold on to the information for some short interval of a few seconds, initially the information is represented in S1 firing patterns, and then within a few hundred milliseconds the working memory trace migrates to S2, therefore transcranial magnetic stimulation here no longer has any effect, and the essential part of the working memory trace is now in S2 cortex, which would explain why people can now make comparisons across fingertips. We tried to, but we could never convince ourselves that it was the proper stimulus site. There are lots of muscles here, and it's a little bit unpleasant. I was one of the subjects, so I can tell you that we looked for S2 in me for a long time, and it's not very pleasant when the stimulus is on a muscle. we could identify the S1 site by an extinction of the tactile input, we couldn't obtain that with S2. We just couldn't convince ourselves that the stimulus site was S2. Right. So we don't exclude prefrontal cortex from working memory. There's very strong evidence for that, which can't be ignored. But we think that prefrontal cortex is probably not the cortical region that's storing specific sensory information, because the neurons there don't seem to have the properties that would allow them to retain the specific information about specific characteristics of sensory stimuli. But we think that there's an interaction between prefrontal cortex and different somatosensory cortical processing fields, both S1 and S2, that allow working memory tasks. Okay, that means it's time for the party. Thanks.
Any questions?
Yes.
Some kind of learning memory change is topographically automated.
Yeah.
Are there space limitations in the sense that when you learn something, something else degrades, or as you learn something?
Because it's in the same cortical. I can't think of evidence that once you've learned something, you can't learn a second thing. But if there are two pardon me?
It's just like the cartoon of the little boy in school going, "Teacher, my brain is full."
Yeah. I don't know of any learning tasks that fill up the brain's capacity for learning for learning new things. Oh, there's so many synapses. Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of any. I can't think of any frameworks that have addressed that.
Going back to your attempt to block the working memory of the late cranial stimulation in S2.
But we didn't stimulate S2.
You were trying. The hypothesis is that this representation moves from S1 somewhere else.
Yes.
Why S2? Why not prefrontal cortex?
Well, we think S2 because from the stimulation, from the TMS, we can't say where the second site is. All we can say is that it's probably not S1 because S1 stimulation no longer had any effect. The reason we think it's S2 is because if people make comparisons between stimuli at 1 to 2 seconds, and there's also data up to 5 seconds, they didn't show, they have a S2-like topography. Meaning opposite finger and neighboring finger. Well, the question is, if information were stored in a non-somatosensory area, would there still be a topography to it? And the answer is no. In fact, if the discrimination is easy enough that you can simply categorize the answer, then of course there's no topography. I mean, if you can attribute a label to it, that was the fast one, then you'll be able to use that information for any comparison with any fingertip. So what we found is that the easier the task, the less topography there is. And of course, if it's semantically labeled, there's no topography at all. So all the testing that we've done here was for a discrimination which, when we probe the subjective experience of the subjects, they report that they, and including me, I was the subject of course a lot, are not able to attribute any label to the stimulus. So what we have to do during the task is actually to hold on to the feeling, the sensation. As soon as it's labelable, then the topography disappears.
So the statement is that you can't categorize the first stimulus until you've felt the second.
Yeah. I mean, really, when you categorize, it's the difference that you want to categorize. Yeah.
Okay, let's all put on our costumes and check back here again.
Okay, thank you.